Hello and welcome to Employment Talk. We're here to discuss the HR issues affecting you and to keep you up to date with the latest employment law news. My name's Jo Mosley. I'm a support lawyer in the employment team. I write our blogs and newsletters, and I keep the team and our clients up to date with what's happening in the world of employment law.
And my name's Elaine Hutley. I'm a partner in the employment team and also the national head.
Hi, Elaine. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Jo. How are you?
Yeah, I'm glad it's Friday. I'm really glad, actually. And the sun is shining, so all's well in the world.
And I heard mention of a potential heat wave, so who knows?
So you'll put the kibosh on that, won't you?
Yeah, sorry. That said, Jo, what are we going to talk about today?
I thought we'd talk about redundancies. We're starting to see quite a few headlines about significant job losses. I noticed over the last couple of weeks, for example, that Ted Baker had announced a number of redundancies, the Metro Bank had. And I thought it was an ideal time for us to perhaps dust off our advice about redundancies. But as this is a HR podcast, I think it's safe to assume that our listeners are going to have a decent understanding of the basics. So I thought that you and I could work through some of the trickier issues. And because I know you like quizzes so much, I'm going to throw in the odd quiz question just to keep you on your toes, national head.
Well, you have let me off for the last couple of weeks. So,
yeah, I think I have actually. I've been pretty kind. Letting you get embedded in first to the podcast. Before we start, can I ask you if our team are giving redundancy advice regularly at the moment?
We are seeing an increase in it, not necessarily redundancies, but definitely restructures, but not to the extent that perhaps I would have thought with the current economic climate. And we're still also having conversations with clients about recruitment, but it's definitely on the increase and something that everybody is starting to think about. But what we are also seeing is we've developed a specialism in advising on mass settlement agreement projects. So actually acting on the other side where we're not acting for the business. But if a business is doing a redundancy program and as part of that, they want to offer the option of voluntary redundancies, they're offering settlement agreements. We have most definitely seen an increase in that because we have the specialism and ability to do it on such a huge scale in a very short period of time. So as much as we're that work isn't the predominant work we're doing at the moment within the team, it is definitely an issue out in the marketplace because we are seeing some big, big restructures and redundancy programs going on.
Yeah, sadly. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Well, I thought we'd start then by looking at fixed term contracts. So let's start with asking you, if they're not renewed, so if you've got somebody on a fixed term contract and that isn't renewed, is that going to amount to a redundancy? And will the employee be entitled to a redundancy payment?
Sometimes yes, and it seems really counterintuitive, and sometimes it catches people out, because if you enter into a contract, a fixed term contract, and you at the very beginning set the end date, it seems really odd that when that end date comes to pass, that the contract doesn't just terminate as it was planned. So the key thing to bear in mind is any fixed term contract that ends, that will be a dismissal in law. Whether it's a dismissal on the grounds of redundancy, that's something that you need to consider, because sometimes it does. So if we look at the definition of redundancy, one of them is that you need fewer employees to do work of a particular kind. That's a redundancy situation. So if that's why the fixed term contract is coming to an end, you could be in a redundancy situation. Sometimes it's not a redundancy situation. So if you've employed someone on a fixed term basis, for example, to cover maternity, it's just that the maternity returner is coming back. So there's still the need for employees to do that work. It's just the situation has changed. So that wouldn't be a redundancy. Yeah. So you need to think about the situation. If you are in that redundancy situation, so the first one I outlined, and if the individual has at least 2 years service, you have to follow a fair process to dismiss, because they'll have a normal unfair dismissal claim. And if it's a redundancy situation, they might have the entitlement to a redundancy payment as well. So one to look out for, because it does catch lots of people out.
Great, thank you. So let's look then at a particular example. And this one's taken from a 2022 case, so it's relatively recent. So are you ready for the facts?
Yes, please.
Keen. Two nurses were employed by a hospital on fixed term contracts. Both were on the same grade. Okay. Nurse A had been employed since 2016 on a series of 1 year fixed term contracts. Nurse B was employed on a two year fixed term contract, and that had only just started. And there then was a redundancy situation. The hospital decided it needed fewer staff on that particular grade, and the hospital made Nurse A, so the one that was on a series of 1 year fixed term contracts, redundant because her contract was due to be renewed first. I mean, it did try and find her alternative employment and all of that stuff, but there was none available. So she was dismissed for redundancy. And she brought a claim. She alleged that she had been unfairly dismissed. And the question for the tribunal was selecting her on the basis of that contract and the fact that it was due to expire first fair? Do you think it was or not? Do you think she won?
I think she did, yeah.
Oh, well done. You're right. Can you give me a bit of an idea why you reached that conclusion?
I do remember this case, actually, because the judgment was quite critical and was quite funny. And so they looked, if I remember it rightly, the judgment looked at it and said, one person has effectively been put in a pool of one and they've been made redundant simply as a matter of timing of when they've chosen to conduct kind of the review and make to put the redundancies into effect versus who they were on this kind of roulette wheel of whose contract was coming up for renewal first. So I think they took issue with the fact that because of that, they'd put her in a pool of one and it was really arbitrary and there was no real meaningful consultation with her then because it was almost like a tick box of you're up for renewal first, therefore you're the first one to go.
Yeah, bang on. Well done. Well done, Elaine. I mean, what the tribunal said is that you need to use objective selection criteria. And obviously, you know, when your fixed term contract is due to expire, isn't that? And you're right. It was quite an amusing case in the sense that the judge likened that scenario of picking the employee closest to the end of their fixed term to a game of musical chairs, where the outcome of who is dismissed is simply at the decision maker's choice of when to turn the music off.
There you go. I knew.
No, no, go on.
I knew there was something like that. I said roulette, but I do remember there was a comical kind of reference in the judgment.
You've got young children. Do they still play musical chairs? Because mine used to love it.
No, it's now all about swimming pool parties and laser quest. And I know it's all changed. Joe. All changed. Gotcha. Virtual reality.
Okay. I think I'd rather laser than having to get into a pool with a load of kids personally, but hey ho.
You just have to make sure you do those when they're old enough and to independently swim, Jo.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's all way past, gone in dim and distant past now for mine. Right then, let's move on then and look at selection criteria. So most employers are going to try and look at objective criteria because it's less likely to be challenged. But one of the things that we are sometimes asked about is whether employers can introduce criteria that is more subjective. Do you have a view on that?
Yes. And it's, in my view, yes, you can introduce subjective criteria, but it is more risky and you do have to be more careful. So you need to be able to evidence the decisions and ideally not just evidence it by someone's account at the time that they are doing the scoring exercise. You would want something that you can link to appraisals or one-to-ones where even if it's a subjective topic, it won't come as a surprise to the individual. So yes, you can use it, but try and think about how you're going to demonstrate it, how you're going to, if you're questioned on it, how you're going to respond to those to say, yes, it's subjective, but actually it's as fair as possible and we've got evidence and it's measurable.
Yeah. I mean, I think in some cases, employers need some element of subjective decision making, don't they? I mean, if you think about people in the creative industries, they are probably going to want to retain those people that, you know, more closely marry with that sort, you know, the sort of work that they're doing. So people that have got, you know, really good ideas and things like that. And that can be difficult to quantify, I think.
It can really. I mean, if you even not in the creative sector, but if you look at the type of work that we do, it is a given that lawyers will be technically excellent. Mm-hmm. You can't survive if you're not. Definitely in our team, but out in the market, you have to be commercial these days. But also it's about relationships and fit with clients and understanding the client's business. And that's where you can get into that subjective criteria. But for us in our day job, those characteristics and those skill sets are incredibly valuable. Yeah. Yeah, they are key. Absolutely key.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to give you some possible selection criteria now, and I want you to say whether you think they're likely to be reasonable, as in fair in the context if you're scoring someone on a redundancy exercise. So are you ready for this one?
I feel like this is a quick fire round, Jo.
It is. It is.
Yes, I'm ready.
On your marks.
Let's do this.
Okay. Right. Okay. Disciplinary record.
Yes.
Okay. Absence.
Yes, but be careful of wider considerations around illnesses, family leave, etc. Yes, be careful.
Yeah. Okay. Job performance over a particular period.
Yes, but think about how you're measuring the performance. So if you've got someone who has underlying medical condition, you've had to make reasonable adjustments, factor that in, and think about the reference period that you're using. So would a particular snapshot affect, be fair to everybody, or would some people be at an advantage or a disadvantage? And I did actually have this. I don't know if I've ever told you, Jo, but not at IM, but at a former firm, I was put at risk of redundancy. And the redundancy came as I came back from maternity leave. So right. They shifted the reference period to the period before I broke up. But then some of the others in the team said, but hang on a minute, because Elaine was going off on maternity leave, I was kind of doing all my housekeeping, making sure files were
working
invoiced
like
and
the
up to date.
Clappers.
Working like the clappers. So actually for that period, I got a spike in my performance. So you have to think of both flip sides to say, not only does it put someone at a disadvantage, but have they done something in unusual or extraordinary circumstances that actually causes a spike in their performance?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. What about attitude or focus?
Yes, but I think that comes back to my earlier comment of attitude. I think, you know, do they go above and beyond, etc., but you have to be careful about their circumstances. So for example, if you're saying they go above and beyond, they work late, well, what if you've got someone with diabetes who can't work late because they have to go home and have a meal? Or what if you've got someone who's got a medical condition which means that they can't travel in the dark? Or what if you've got someone who's got caring responsibilities either for elderly relatives or young children? So potentially, but again, be careful and think it through.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that was quite a mean one actually, because it's so fact specific, isn't it? I picked those two actually because there's two cases where those two attributes were really given short shrift by tribunals. So attitude in one of these cases, and that was 1986, was described as dangerously ambiguous and vague. I can't remember the full details of that case, so I can't fill in the gaps, I'm afraid. And focus was considered to be discrimination on the grounds of sex when it was applied to a mother of four who worked for British Gas, and that was in 2022. And you might remember that case as well. I think she was a solicitor. And what they said in that case was that it was irrational and contrary to the evidence that actually had been presented, that her focus was good in respect of most of the work that she did. It was a way really of trying to get rid of her, using a sort of ambiguous term. Okay, last one then. What about buy-in to company values?
I'm going to say, I've said yes, but be careful to the other ones. But I think on that one, I'm going to say no, because I'm not sure what it means or how it affects their ability to do the job. I think that one for me is too ambiguous that I would struggle with that one. If a client said to me that's what they wanted, I'd have to explore that with them and say, well, tell me what you mean by it and tell me how that is has pervaded the workplace such that it affects how people do their job, and how do you measure it? That one, no, I'm going to say.
I think that actually what you've said there is bang on, but it was accepted in theory by a tribunal in 2008. That was a case called Howard versus Siemens. And the reason for that was because the tribunal found that the values were accountable and were therefore reasonably measurable. But I agree, as a concept, it just sounds a bit vague, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So do you have any sense of why employers choose inappropriate, as in unfair or discriminatory criteria? Because we see cases still, you know, coming through the system now. Employers make mistakes on this, and big employers make mistakes on this. It's not just, you know, Mr. I've got a couple of employees I want to get rid of.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's, I would say in the vast majority of cases, it's not intentional. I think a lot of employers think they know what they mean and why it has importance in the criteria. So, for example, attitude or focus. I suspect they know what they want to get to, but they're not very good at articulating it. And sometimes these things can come as a surprise to the individuals. And then if you don't have evidence as to why that's one important in terms of why should it be a selection criteria that I have to attain or demonstrate, and two, well, why are you suddenly scoring me lowly for that criteria? Nobody's ever said that before. And then you get this real scrutiny. And if you can't explain that, it comes across as being inappropriate. So there's a lot of preparation work that should go into what is important for the role that we're retaining and what makes someone the strongest person to do that and what are the needs of it, technical, commercial, wider within the business. But I think it comes down to, in most cases, a lack of preparation and then a lack of kind of articulation to the employee.
Fair enough. Fair enough. OK, let's move on and look at pools now, as in who you put in the pool to consider for redundancy and who you exclude. So let's start by dispelling a few myths about pregnant women or women on maternity leave. Should you exclude them from the pool, Elaine?
Absolutely not. The number of times I've heard, oh, but they're pregnant, so I can't make them redundant. And then they're taken out almost like they're bulletproof and they're preserved. It is right that pregnant women, and now actually people, or soon to come in, people who come back from maternity leave, do have enhanced protections. But that doesn't mean that they're excluded from the process. So the fact should be, everybody, including any pregnant employees that you have, go into the pot for consideration. So they go into the pool, as long as they're doing work of a similar nature, or if their work's interchangeable, we define the pool with all of the employees in there for consideration. Where their additional rights do come in is when they would score lowest, or if they're in a pool of one, if they are provisionally selected for redundancy. So if they're at the highest risk and it's looking likely that they could be made redundant, at that point they have the additional protections. But absolutely, they should be included in the pool and treated fairly with everybody else.
Brilliant. Thank you. And you mentioned, didn't you, that those same principles now apply to other parents that are on family-related leave?
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, I suppose what we also ought to mention is that pregnant women also now have that protection, don't they? In the sense that if they are provisionally selected for redundancy, even if they are not yet on maternity leave, they have a right to a suitable alternative role in priority to other people.
They do. And the changes came into effect this month, which extends their protection as well. So it's 18 months from childbirth.
Course, yeah.
So it's not just their maternity leave. Actually, it's for an extended period. So it could be when they've returned from maternity leave and they're back in the workplace, they still have that extra protection.
Yeah, so I suppose if you think about it, for women, they would have, or potentially would have, around two years protection, wouldn't they? Assuming that they notify their employer early doors when they become pregnant.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right, let's now move on to talk about mobility clauses. Can employers rely on mobility clauses in an employee's contract of employment to avoid making redundancy payments?
Possibly, but you can't just make unilateral changes of someone's contracts of employment or working arrangements. So it's not a get out of jail free card just by the fact that you've got a mobility clause in someone's contract. So the wording has to be clear and unambiguous, and it can't be overly detrimental to the employee. And in how you exercise or rely on the mobility clause, you have to be reasonable. So for example, if you've got a poorly drafted mobility clause in your contract and you've got an employee who's been with you for a decent amount of time and you've never relied on it, and you have a redundancy situation and then you want to move them 20 miles up the road and it's the other side of where they live from your workplace, it's going to be difficult to say, well, we don't have to make you redundant because now we're going to use this clause that you've never looked at, you probably have forgotten was in your contract if you ever knew in the first place, and your commute's going to go up by an extra hour. But it's okay because you're not redundant because we've got a mobility clause. You wouldn't be able to get away with that. It is still subject to general principles of fairness and what's reasonable.
Okay, so let me get your response then to these scenarios, and they're both based on real life cases, okay? Mm-hmm. So you give a long-standing employee 6 days' notice of your intention to move their job location from Leeds to Birmingham.
I don't think that's going to be reasonable. Whether you could commercially get away with it by convincing the employee that you'll put lots in place, you know, you'll provide accommodation while they make the move, etc., you know, to help them. And if assuming they could and they haven't got family ties and they're not, you know, having to uproot kids, you might be able to practically try and manage that situation. But I think, could you insist on it? No, I don't think so. Having been stuck on a train from Leeds only this week because my train got cancelled and turned from one train of an hour and a half journey to three trains of nearly a 4 hour journey. No, that's not a little easy thing.
Oh, God. No.
And I think that was my Tuesday.
I think you've already answered this one, but this was a situation where somebody they were changing the location of the job, the employee was nearing retiring age and their commute would go up from 18 minutes each way to 47 minutes each way.
I think, you know, to double and more than double someone's commute is a significant change. And I think the important thing on this, so I'm going to say no, I don't think that was fair. I think when you're looking at what's reasonable, it's you've got to take into account the circumstances for an employee. So for me, for example, a 47 minute commute is nothing. That's my daily commute. But if someone else has only ever been doing 18 minutes, and for example, they don't drive or they rely on public transport, you've got to look at their personal situation of how it impacts them. So no, I don't think that one was a flyer.
It wasn't. Neither of them were. No. Okay, so obviously when we're talking about these sorts of things, it's not just about having appropriate wording in the contract, is it? You've got to act in a way that doesn't destroy the implied duty of mutual trust and confidence. So I suppose even if you believe that your contractual term is clear and will allow you to move an employee from one place to another, as you've said, if the scope of the change is unreasonable or the way in which you manage it is unreasonable, the employee is likely to be able to resign and claim constructive dismissal. And of course, they'll only be able to do that if they've got 2 years service. But often we're talking here about, you know, if you're trying to avoid a redundancy payment, then they're going to have 2 years service anyway, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the key to that, if ever I'm going into a redundancy situation and it involves a relocation, actually what I tend to do with clients is look at the map and then individually and have a look at their personal circumstances. So generally the HR team will know, do they drive, whereabouts do they live, which side is it compared to the current location and the new location, do they rely on public transport, and we actually map out the likely impact that it would be rather than just going, well, it's a 20 minute or 20 right. mile difference between location X and location Y, because that gives you the ability then to look at your workforce and say, how many people are likely to have an issue with this? Who are the ones that are going to struggle the most? Go into meaningful conversations and see whether there's any alternatives. I did have a client once who moved and they actually put on a minibus service to help people who, for transport, because it was off a bus route, at least as an interim measure, whilst they could have kind of ongoing conversations about if anybody wanted to relocate. So it's all well and good to look at the contract, but it's actually the practicalities. Yeah. And as you've said, Jo, how you manage the situation and the good conversations that you can have so people aren't alienated as soon as you make the announcement. It shows that kind of investment and proactive side.
Very good tips. Right. OK, we're going to finish by talking about bumping. Now, I'm going to confess, I've never really understood the principle behind this, and I'm hoping that you might be able to enlighten me.
I'm not sure I can, because it is a bizarre concept, but I think somewhere underneath there, it's about retaining the strongest people in the business. So if you've got an absolute superstar who is at risk of redundancy and you can't stop their redundancy looking at the role that they do, but they have the skill set to do another job, and you've got someone in there that isn't the strongest performer, potentially they can bump, but it is really distasteful and it causes all sorts of problems, as I'm sure we're about to discuss.
Well, I mean, you've sort of explained what bumping is, haven't you? And I think probably what we ought to do for those of our listeners that are not completely familiar with it is just to sort of, you know, put a little bit more flesh on the bones in that. So is the person that is bumped out of their job, so the person that that was in a otherwise job that wouldn't have been made redundant, who is then moved out of that so that the person that would have been made redundant can go into it, that's going to feel incredibly unfair to them. But in law, their dismissal is treated as a redundancy. And obviously, if they've got 2 years service, they're entitled to receive a redundancy payment. And I've said it will seem very unfair to that person. To my ears, it is unfair. Can you explain to me why the law doesn't see it necessarily as being unfair?
Wish I could, Jo. No, legally. I guess, if you use you and I as a good example, so we are both employment lawyers, mm-hmm. but our roles are very different. So I am client-facing, fee-earning, I advise clients. You are the guru and goddess of employment law, and you do all of our podcasts, all of our updates. You keep the team in check. But technically, we both know employment law. So I'm going to do it this way around because there's no way I could bump you. But say your role was at risk of redundancy. My role isn't because I still, you know, they still need fee earners. But they're saying in terms of knowledge management and all the brilliant stuff that you guys do, you potentially could point at me and say, well, I know the employment law just as well as Elaine does, and just because I don't fear doesn't mean I couldn't advise clients. So you could point at me and go, make Elaine redundant and I'll step in, hence why I couldn't do this situation the other way around, and you could slot into my role. I would still be treated as being made redundant because I'm being outed as a consequence of your redundancy situation, albeit it's one step removed. So if you put the common sense kind of feeling of general unfairness and this can't be moral and it can't be right aside, legally it tracks of one role isn't needed. You can push me out because you can do my role. What's the reason for me, my employment ending? It is because of an indirect redundancy situation.
Yeah,
I think that's the legal logic of it, despite the fact that it's completely illogical. Yeah. Common sense level.
I mean, it still sounds pretty mad to me, although I wouldn't mind the pay increase if I was to bump you out of the way. But anyway, can't employers just say no?
Yes, they can. So if an employee raises it, you should consider it, because that's part of meaningful consultation. And it is a way that an individual's redundancy could be avoided. So when you're thinking about all of the options to reduce the number or to avoid redundancies, bumping is a legitimate factor to consider. But an employer can say, we don't want to do that. That's not an option we want to consider. And if you are making multiple people redundant, trying to manage that process when it's not just, yeah, it gets super, super complicated and it gets really emotive amongst the employees who are affected. So lots of employers do standard response, say, it's not something we want to consider.
Okay, Okay, I was going to ask you that actually, whether you do see many, and I'm just having looked at some of the case law in preparation for this, there's just not that much case law on it, which suggests that most employers don't really consider it. Because I'd imagine if lots of them are doing it and lots of people are being bumped, that's a recipe for grievances, appeals, and all sorts of stuff.
It is. It's not something that employers tend to want to take forward. It's not actually raised by employees an awful lot either, because you've got to imagine for them to sit there and say I should bump, they've got to point to a colleague and say sack them, which is quite a difficult thing to do in a business where you know your colleagues. It's not an anonymous process. You are actually personally targeting someone else to save yourself. So it doesn't crop up all the time on every redundancy. It does crop up from time to time, but it doesn't often get followed through into the process.
No, that makes sense. No. Can you imagine how to win friends and influence people? I want your job. I don't, by the way.
I don't know why you wouldn't, Jo.
Oh, goodness me. No. So any nice plans for the weekend?
We are decorating and DIYing, maybe a bit of gardening. How about you?
Oh, wow. No, I'm having fun this weekend. Going out walking, drinking with friends, and yeah, just doing nice things really.
Can I bump your weekend?
No. No, you can't. I've got a big enough garden of my own to try and wade through, but no, it's not getting done this weekend despite the sunshine. Right, well, I think that's it for today. Please tune in next month if you want to hear more about Elaine's gardening tips or anything else in relation to employment law, alongside our expert commentary. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.